Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in African Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am Esperanza Brizuela Garcia, and today I will be talking to Dr. Emily Kalachi about her book, Street Archives and City Life, Popular Intellectuals in Postcolonial Tanzania, published by Duke University Press in 2017. Dr. Kalachi is Associate Professor of History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Dr. Kalachi, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Esperanza.
I wonder if you could get our conversation started just by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, let's see. I was born in Providence, Rhode Island, or rather I grew up there. And I guess I really got interested in African history when I was an undergraduate at college. You know, I went to Kenyon College in Ohio. And I actually started as a music major. I was really interested in jazz, and I was a drummer. And that was what I planned to major in. But I took an introductory level history class in African history with Professor Clifton Crace, and he's now at Emory. But the class just really blew my mind. I just thought it was the most interesting thing I had ever studied before. You know, we read the works of Frantz Fanon and Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, and I just was so hooked that I changed my major, became a history major. And, and I took a semester to study abroad in Kenya. So that's really what, you know, kind of got me really excited about African history. When I was in Kenya, I started to really intensively study Swahili, which is just the most gorgeous language. And I got so interested in that. And I had a mentor there in Kenya, a professor named Othman Lali Omar, who was an archaeologist. And, you know, he was just such an incredibly inspiring teacher. He really kind of encouraged us in our love of the language and music and art. And so, you know, with his kind of encouragement, I really just became, you know, really, really excited and passionate about, East African history and particularly the history of cities in East Africa, which has a very, very long kind of history in the region. So that was kind of how I got started and interested in African history, was kind of through a few sort of random kind of, you know, choices, like taking an introductory level class, you know, and then getting really hooked further when I was studying abroad in Kenya. And so a few years after graduating, I went to get my PhD at Northwestern University, and it kind of took off from there.
Great. And so how did you start work on street archives and city life? Was that part of your PhD work? Is that how do you get to write this book?
Yeah, so it came out of my dissertation. My dissertation was kind of the first version of it. It took me a while to kind of get to it. So I don't think the kind of idea of a street archive was really there in the dissertation. Basically, I had gone to Tanzania to, I was interested in urban migration. So I was trying to kind of understand this contradiction of, or tension rather, of you have this, you know, really exciting program of African socialism in Tanzania in the 1960s and 70s, you know, that's largely based on the idea of creating a kind of rural, you know, agrarian kind of socialist society. But at the same time, you have massive, you know, urban growth during that time period. So I wanted to kind of understand the lives of the young people that were moving to the city at this time, which kind of led me to the archives looking for evidence of you know, their lives and perspectives and their motivations and, you know, what led them to come to the city and what their lives were like when they got there. So I went to the archives, and basically the National Archives, you know, really hoping to find that thing that I think so many of us historians hope to find, which is, you know, the voices of everyday people. You know, I think the hope is always to find something that you can read against the grain. You know, you see these kind of, you know, government reports and, you know, those kinds of official kinds of sources, you're really always hoping to find the kind of lives of people kind of popping up in unexpected places. But I was really disappointed in the archives. You know, I wasn't really finding that so much. You know, I got a lot of information about official urban policy, you know, particularly the attempts to kind of get people out of the city, you know, to prevent urban growth and to discipline the population, you know, through policing and through slum demolitions and that kind of stuff. But it was really hard to kind of get at the perspectives of people that moved to the city during that time. And that was what I was really interested in. So I was really discouraged. You know, I was wondering if I had to change my dissertation topic. I was thinking it was just not going to be possible to write the kind of project I wanted to write. But then meanwhile, you know, in the process of kind of spending time in Dar es Salaam, you know, all these other little bits of information, you know, kind of found their way to me as I kind of just, you know, looked around the city where I was spending my time, you know. So one thing in particular, I remember, you know, there are all these basically these cassette tape sellers, these you know, usually young men who kind of push these carts around the city with all these cassette tapes that are kind of, you know, pirated copies of all different kinds of different sorts of recordings. You know, a lot of them are, for example, you know, religious music or, you know, Bible readings, you know, Islamic text, but also lots of popular music, you know, from all different kinds of eras of Tanzanian music. And I started to find all these cassette tapes that were pirated copies of albums from the 70s. So that was interesting to me. I thought, okay, I'm not really finding much about the lives of urban dwellers in these official archives. What about the music that they were making and singing? You know, how could that maybe be a way into these questions I have? Similarly, you know, there are all these used booksellers across the city. And I start to kind of collect these books that I would find there, particularly these kind of urban pulp fiction books that are these kind of crime novellas, you know, published and very popular among young people in the 70s. So I started to kind of look more for sources like that, you know, like outside of the kind of archives of urban policy and policing and into the more kinds of creative forms of expression in the city at that time. And that's how I kind of came to refocus my dissertation on the kind of popular culture of the city in that time period. So that was all kind of happening as I was doing my dissertation research. I don't think I really had a sense of this as a kind of coherent approach until I started to revise it for a book later on. I was kind of making up as I go along, but eventually I kind of came to see that as the core of the work is looking at these alternative kinds of sources as evidence of urban life.
I was actually wanted to ask you about that because as I was reading through the book, it made me think precisely of that, of kind of that moment when you're starting to find pieces, when you recognize as pieces of a story, but you don't quite know, you're still not sure how to tell it. You know, you're not still sure how to use them and how to put them together and how to make sense of them. And it's clearly that your book, you know, is both revolutionary, but still part of a lot of different strands of historiography. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the different sort of trends within African history that that informed you as you were trying to make sense of this evidence, and also the ones that you were trying to sort of like speak, not just the ones that you were dialoguing with, but also the ones that you were trying to speak against too, if I would. I'm going to say it that way. In other words, what's the historiography that you're working with and that help you make sense of this evidence?
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that question. So I guess there are several kinds of strands that were most interesting to me. You know, I think actually some of the scholarship that was most kind of influential to me was actually not so much in history, but in other disciplines like literature and anthropology. I got really interested, for example, in you know, the work of Corinne Barber, who studies, you know, popular literacy and literature in Nigeria, particularly, you know, Yoruba texts. And so I got really interested in how you can kind of read texts as active components of social life rather than simply as kind of, you know, evidence of some kind of you know, empirical reality. So I got really interested in the kind of anthropology of print culture, if that makes sense. Writers like her, like Isabel Hoffmeyer, a scholar of literature who writes largely about South Africa. I was very influenced by historian Derek Peterson, who wrote a first book that, isn't as famous as his later books, but called Creative Writing, about basically textuality and writing in Kenya, particularly in central Kenya in the colonial period, and how, you know, everyday acts of literacy, you know, in, for example, translating the Bible, you know, into Kikuyu, or, writing testimony in court cases, or, you know, writing letters, these kinds of practices of literacy can reveal a lot about the social worlds of people, how they attempted to kind of assert control over their lives and realities through the use of the written word. So I found that to be a really kind of interesting kind of, scholarship to kind of engage with and build on. Similarly, there's been such a kind of wave of urban scholarship in African history as well. I mean, there have been a lot of histories of Dar es Salaam in particular, James Brennan and Andrew Voska and Andrew Burton in particular, the kind of three historians who've written a lot about Dar es Salaam, in recent years. So I had like a lot of work to kind of stand on and kind of be inspired by, as I was trying to write my own history. And in some ways, my work wouldn't have been possible without those earlier histories of Dar es Salaam, because it kind of, because they had done such great work laying out the kind of political history of the city, how the city kind of arose alongside the history of, both the colonial state and also, the rise of TANU as the ruling party, because they did that kind of work. I then could kind of focus more on these aspects of cultural expression, being able to kind of rely on that history without having to kind of do that research myself. So that was really made it a really kind of, kind of enabled the project that I wanted to do. In terms of scholarship that I was trying to speak against, I'm not sure that there really was much of a kind of argument against anything I was making. I guess in some ways I was trying to sort of open up some of the conversations about African socialism in Tanzania, which is such an important and inspiring and interesting history. And I think that, the scholarship on it tends to be pretty divided between, studies of the kind of rural experiments with socialism and the urban experience of people who were kind of fleeing that project. But I, those histories, of course, are very, very connected because people were so mobile. I mean, everybody in the city of Dar es Salaam, or almost everybody in the city, had come from one of these rural areas. So I was trying to kind of understand how, experiences of the urban and of the rural were really kind of connected in the history of Ujamaa and Tanzania, and particularly ideas about political citizenship. So I guess I was trying to sort of, maybe take that in a kind of a different direction.
As a matter of fact, I feel that in some ways, what you were very successful at is precisely in kind of moving beyond that dichotomy, isn't it? In the sense that you were able to create, basically saying that the experiences of these migrants were not forged in the midst of that, am I urban or am I rural, but, I'm just doing my thing with the resources that I have and doing the best I can with what's available to me. And I feel like obviously that just to a large extent comes out of being informed by the evidence where that dichotomy is not necessarily the most dominant one. I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about sort of the setting, the setting of African socialism that TANU tried to sort of experiment with. and so we can talk a little bit about this is what the story that you tell in chapter one and how these started to affect changes in the way in which, this dichotomy between the rural or the urban was shaped or started to be shaped during this period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so it's a complicated question, and there's I want to signal a couple of other scholars that have written so compellingly about the history of African socialism, and particularly Priya Lal at Boston College has written a really wonderful book about the history of Ujamaa in Tanzania. So I recommend that for further reading. So in terms of the, you know, the way it kind of comes up in the first chapter of my book and the kind of setting, I really try to understand in that chapter a kind of shift that I see happening over the course of the socialist period, kind of roughly from 1967 to 1985. So in 1967, you have, you know, the Arusha Declaration, you know, in which, you know, Julius Nyerere and his kind of his TANU, you know, comrades, you know, make this kind of proclamation of African socialism, laying out this kind of plan for a kind of self-reliant nation, you know, that can, you know, basically kind of build up its economy and its nation with its own resources, you know, without kind of having to be reliant on, you know, Western aid, without having to be reliant on a kind of, you know, mode of production kind of imported from the West, and kind of being able to sort of assert their kind of political autonomy through that. And the central kind of economic plank of that was the idea of villagization, the idea that Africans in the rural villages would, you know, organize themselves into these collectivized village units, you know, to kind of take part in this kind of socialist project of uplift. And the idea was that this was something that was, you know, part of traditional African society, and, you know, and people would take it up voluntarily. And while that was true in some cases, in many cases it wasn't true. The people did not take it up voluntarily. In fact, lots of people were migrating to the cities or simply just going on about life as they had been before. And so, you know, in the 70s, there was a shift from this kind of policy of, you know, voluntarily organizing into these self-reliant villages to a kind of coercive policy of trying to force people to move into these villages. And so that to me is, so I think when we talk about African socialism, you know, we have to see something that changes over time, you know, that kind of, you know, takes a kind of more authoritarian turn in the second half of it. And so how this kind of affects the sort of urban aspect of it, I mean, the program becomes, it, or rather political rhetoric takes a much more kind of anti-urban turn in the second kind of part of that time period. You know, one of the things that I talk about in that chapter of my book is how in the early days of African socialism, you know, urban modernization was a big part of the project, or, you know, that was true from the early days of independence as well. The idea that, you know, an independent modern African nation, you know, would have, you know, a major developed city, there would be wage labor employment, there would be middle class living, there would be all the kind of trappings of urban modernity, you know, that many people had kind of aspired towards during the colonial period, but had not been able to attain, you know, because of colonial repression, colonial racism, because, you know, urban policies were so much geared towards extracting wealth rather than promoting a kind of, you know, African prosperity. So there were these promises of urban infrastructure, of public housing, of, you know, all these kinds of urban modernization kind of programs. But, you know, towards, you know, as this kind of became less tenable, you know, particularly in the face of massive kind of urban migration and kind of unplanned, you know, urban squatter settlements, and also in the context of real kinds of economic problems, particularly in the 1970s, you know, with the oil shocks and other kinds of, you know, the kind of collapse of the economy. There was a real kind of effort to really kind of ratchet back those promises of urban modernization. And what went along with that was this real kind of vilification of the city as the site of all the kind of ills of the country. That, you know, it was the urban dwellers, these urban youth were the cause of a lack of development. They were the kind of obstacle to socialism, these young people that were going to the city, you know, because of greed or because of materialism, rather than doing their duty to the nation and going back to the rural areas to do farm work. So there's this real kind of anti-urban turn that kind of comes about in the second part of the you know, particularly in the 1970s.
In terms of the sources that you start exploring, that you started to find, like you explained to us. So you start in chapter two by looking at sort of like advice literature, if we can call it that way, mostly produced by, I guess, middle-class women who are trying to warn, inform, and help girls or younger, I guess, younger women who are moving into the city to try to still conduct themselves in sort of like in a Christian way. So you start pointing out like all the different contradictions that the different contradictions in city life that this type of literature highlights. Can you tell us a little bit about these particular types of sources? You know, when did you encounter them, and when did you start realizing, piecing together sort of like the setting, you know, in which they were operating and the contradictions that they were pointing to?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So one of the texts that I guess there are two major texts that I found really interesting that I kind of organized a chapter around. The first is this little kind of advice book / novella by a writer called Martha Mandau called Pekeyangu Mjini, or All Alone in the City, which is basically an advice kind of manual for young Christian girls who have moved to the city for salaried employment, and particularly advice about how to maintain a Christian style of living in this kind of evil, decadent, you know, kind of city full of temptations to stray from the Christian lifestyle, you know, as she portrayed it anyway. And the second text that really interested me was this social science survey produced by these professors at the University of Dar es Salaam and some graduate students there, or I don't know if they're students there, where they'd go out into the urban neighborhoods and interview women about their lives. And they would produce them kind of in collaboration with the women, kind of as a kind of self-ethnography of life in the city for women. So I found both of these texts really interesting as historical sources, both in terms of what they kind of told me about urban life, but also about these different kinds of ideas about urban living. So the first one, this kind of advice book by Martha Mandau. Martha Mandau was she wrote children's books. She wrote this advice book. She had a radio program on a Lutheran radio station for many years. So she was something of a public figure, particularly in the kind of Christian community in Dar es Salaam, but also throughout Tanzania. She was herself from Moshi, which is inland a little bit and near Mount Kilimanjaro. And so I started to kind of try to learn about the social context in which, you know, she portrays the city as this real kind of site of crisis for young women. And so I wanted to kind of build the social context in which that was the case. And part of the context for that was, Dar es Salaam and the coast in general of Tanzania has historically been a predominantly Muslim part of the country. But one of the kind of tensions with colonial rule and also then the independence period is that, in terms of, you know, so missionary education in Tanzania became, one of the kind of major paths towards upward mobility, particularly as the economy shifted towards a kind of, wage labor economy. So you have, with independence, a lot of the white collar workers in the city were migrants, from upcountry who had had this kind of missionary education, who were literate in English, who, you know, could occupy these kinds of positions, you know, in offices and in the kind of, you know, emerging middle class. So this led to some kinds of tensions in the city. You know, you have these older forms of wealth and status that are linked to, you know, access to urban property, to kind of, you know, Islamic kind of cultural networks and institutions in the city. There's a long tradition, for example, of female property ownership in Dar es Salaam. People tend to organize their lives or their kind of social, their family lives, you know, around kind of extended family networks. Whereas these new kind of generation of migrants that become a much bigger part of the urban economy, you know, in the 60s and onward, are people who generally live in a kind of nuclear family unit. You know, they live in detached houses. They largely are modeling their lives on this kind of, you know, middle class nuclear family ideal. And so there's this real kind of tension in the urban lifestyles of these different kind of communities. And of course, there are lots that I'm oversimplifying here, but this is one of the kind of tensions that I think comes up in this advice literature. So Martha Mandau's book is kind of writing to, this kind of imaginary audience of young Christian women about how to move to the city, but to not get swept up in the kinds of temptations of urban life, to not kind of become part of the, you know, economic networks of other women, to not kind of, you know, go out to the dance halls at night, go out to the cinema, but to kind of maintain a kind of respectable Christian home in preparation for someday, you know, becoming a respectable married woman, you know, either in the city or back home in the rural area. So it was really interesting. It was a kind of, you know, urbanism. She's giving advice to young women about how to live in the city, how to become, you know, salaried employees, you know, and how to have a good work ethic and, you know, all that kind of thing. But it's also a very anti-urban text in many ways, because it has such kind of you know, expresses such fear and such kind of judgment of the urban life of the city itself, you know. So I found that really interesting, the way that might be mapped on in some ways into the actual physical formation of the city, you know, where you have these new neighborhoods being built up, organized again largely around the nuclear family. You know, you have these hostels for girls that were trying to kind of wall them off from the city. And so that seemed to me like a kind of interesting kind of tension.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And in with regards to the, I mean, I found the stories of the of that second group of sources that he used in this chapter of this University of Dar es Salaam students quite fascinating, you know, in terms of having this, you know, going out and doing this sort of participatory ethnography while at the same time trying to affect some change in the lives of the women that they were studying. It's can you tell us a little bit more about sort of like the difference between the kind of change and the kind of urban lifestyle that these students were trying to contribute to as in comparison with what this sort of Christian literature advice literature was trying to do.
Sure. Thank you for that question. I also found that source really, really interesting. And, you know, one of the ways I kind of contrast these two texts is that while the kind of Christian literature was kind of seeing, you know, the city as a threat to the nuclear family and as a kind of, you know, something to be guarded against, you know, these women, you know, from the University of Dar es Salaam really saw the kind of, you know, the kind of extended family networks, the female trade networks, the entrepreneurialism of these cities actually a source of radical potential, you know, that these women, you know, I mean, so I'll back up for a second here. So, you know, it was talking about these working class African neighborhoods in Dar es Salaam. And, you know, the norm of life in those communities was not so much organizing your home life around the nuclear family. There was a tradition, for example, of women having economic autonomy from their husbands, having their own kind of trading enterprises. Divorce was very common, and it wasn't, you know, there was no kind of moral judgment of that. It was, you know, part of the cycle of life, you know, like, and, you know, there was a political scientist or historian rather, Susan Geiger, who observed that, you know, she wrote this book about women who were active in TANU, you know, the political party that, you know, fought colonial regime and won independence in Tanzania. You know, women who were from these communities were much more free to organize politically because they had free time, they had economic autonomy, you know. So there's this kind of potential in this kind of way of living that's very different from the kind of perspective of these Christian writers that are trying to resist that, are trying to make respectable middle-class nuclear families. So these sociologists are going into these urban areas and doing and trying to involve these women in a kind of you know, self-study. You know, it was part of the literacy program of TANU at that time, where they were going out to community centers, to factories, and teaching women how to read, and then also inviting those women to kind of study themselves and to write about their lives and to participate in these social studies. So there was this sense that, you know, you could find in these communities a kind of potential for, you know, a kind of, you know, project of feminist, you know, collaboration, or women kind of asserting their own kind of agenda and their own kind of urban, you know, itineraries and ideas. I think at the same time, though, a lot of, you know, these women from the university, you know, were also, I mean, one of them was actually herself a union organizer in one of the factories in Dar es Salaam. So there was a real kind of political engagement there as well. I think at times, though, there was always a kind of, you know, I don't think there was ever an ability to really break down the kind of difference between, you know, these educated women from the university and these women in the neighborhoods, because, you know, oftentimes in the survey, what you see is an expression of a real kind of disappointment that women aren't more, you know, politically motivated. They're not participating in the kinds of projects that would, you know, they were kind of going about their lives and not always having the same kind of aspirations that these sociologists had for them. So that tension, I think, is part of it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also it's interesting that as, you know, as you read through the book in this chapter, and we will probably hear about the following chapters, there's always a really interesting relationship between each and every one of these sort of authors, if you want to call them that, bodies of literature or of these writings with the idea of socialism, you know, in mm-hmm. a way. Like, I really appreciated how, you know, you started with this sort of like, if you want to call it official history of socialism, or how it sort of was supposed to, what were the policies, what were they trying to achieve, you know, and how they were trying to achieve it. And then in each and every one of the the types of texts that you examine, you realize that in some ways they're not necessarily opposing it, but they're just engaging it in different ways, you know, mm-hmm. and in different manners. The idea of literacy, like you mentioned it there, but it basically underpins the entire book. And literacy was one of those central projects of Tano. Can you tell us a little bit more about, before we move forward to the next chapters, just to remind ourselves of that, how important this project to expand literacy in Tanzania was mm-hmm. for the socialist project?
Yeah, thank you so much for that question. That is really important, and I'm so glad that you brought it up. So that was one of the big kind of aspirations of Nyerere, and also one of the major accomplishments of his, of the time that he was president. So literacy, you know, like, as we know, like, you know, colonial regime did not really prioritize literacy as something that everyone should have access to. You know, they prioritized it as something that a certain cadre of people should have access to so they could be kind of, you know, productive for the colonial enterprise. So literacy rates in Tanzania at the time of independence from colonial rule, were roughly around, 11 or so percent. Of course, these statistics are always, imperfect, but that's the kind of statistic that we generally have. I think that one comes from UNESCO. By the time socialism was over in the 80s, literacy rates of Tanzanians were up in the 60s, around 69%. So it's a major accomplishment, and just, like the matter of a decade or two, literacy rates had gone up, by a massive amount, from 11 to around 69%. So this is a major part of the socialist kind of program, was extending literacy to people, and not just to kind of, young people in schools, but also to the elderly. There was this, project of getting young people to go out to their communities and to teach literacy to their elders and to peasants and to people in the countryside and to workers in the factories. That was part of the idea behind socialism, was that you would get, people would have literacy. There's also the idea that would then also kind of enlist them into the kind of socialist project by making these texts available to them that could kind of educate them in the kind of ethos and ideals of African socialism. So you see a massive kind of outpouring of state-produced kind of literature about socialism in that time period. There are all kinds of primers and textbooks, for people. Often having parables about, socialist living, what makes a good kind of socialist life? What is a male head of household in a socialist community? How is he supposed to act towards his wife and children? What kinds of, principles of community life should one kind of adhere to? And these are all texts that are written with a kind of simple vocabulary that someone who has only, recently learned how to read can read and understand. So you just, if you go to any library in Tanzania, you just see tons and tons of these texts. And so it's interesting because, on the one hand, like, literacy was part of this plan to kind of make good socialists, within the kind of model envisioned by TANU in the state. At the same time, you know, this literacy project enabled other forms of literary output that were not very much in line with that kind of project. You know, people were writing all kinds of things and reading all kinds of things that were not, you know, primers on how to, you know, grow the right crops or how to live a socialist life, you know, but for example, pulp fiction books from abroad, you know, or magazines, Drum magazine from South Africa, you know, other kinds of literacy became really kind of, you know, really flourished in the socialist period, which I think is one of the kind of interesting kind of unintended consequences of the literacy project.
Yeah, and the amount of, as we will see in you know, in this other chapters, the part as being part of the social, as part of the socialist project, when things were banned from entering, that kind of encouraged that internal production that ends up being so both representing sort of you know, new moral communities, a new ethos, but also starts to recreate sort of like the social fabric of the city. So let's talk a little bit about that. In the third chapter, you move into a new body of texts. In this case, are basically songs that allow you to look into sort of the dynamics of nightlife in Dar es Salaam. Again, I imagine that some of this came to you through those cassette player, those cassettes that you encounter in the streets. How did you, I'm fascinated. How, did you track the singers or some of the musicians? How did you encounter these songs, this music, and how do you put this chapter together?
Mm-hmm. Thanks. So, yeah, as you point out, you know, one of the first kind of sources that I turned to was these cassette tapes, and I would just kind of listen and transcribe all of them and try to get at, you know, what was happening in them, you know, transcribe the lyrics. I did, as you suggested, I interviewed a lot of musicians. I went to see a lot of music when I was in Dar es Salaam, particularly the year I was there for my dissertation research. And I would, you know, often just a lot of the musicians who were active in the 70s are still active or were still, you know, playing music in, you know, excuse me, in 2008. So I would, you know, transcribe all these lyrics, and then I would, you know, find, I think I interviewed around 80 musicians or so. But, you know, I would interview them both about their lives, their process of migrating to the city, the kinds of social networks they found in the city, you know, their creative life as a musician. And then I'd interview them about the actual songs that they wrote, you know, like, and one of the things that I was really delighted to find was that a lot of these songs were about actual things that had happened, like actual little disputes within neighborhoods, you know. So for example, like, you know, a lot of the songs, you know, that have like, you know, a woman's name in the title are actually like about one of the singer's girlfriends or, you know, or their sister, or like, these were these really kind of local community debates about, you know, this society they're living in, the community they're living in. And so being able to kind of, you know, both understand the bigger kind of context of urban migration that led them to the city and what life was like in the city and their friendship networks, you know, how they made it as a band, you know, but also the ways in which the songs they were writing were kind of linked to these really intimate debates about, you know, community life in the city and what it meant to live in the city, was really a lot of fun. So I spoke to musicians, I interviewed musicians, I transcribed song lyrics. You know, I found a lot of, you know, kind of newspaper articles about, you know, different bands and dance clubs and stuff. I also interviewed some bouncers who used to work at these nightclubs. I interviewed taxi drivers who used to kind of shuttle people around to different kind of dance halls. So I tried to really get a kind of, you know, do a kind of historical ethnography of nightlife in Dar es Salaam in the 70s.
And I think what's interesting also, and you mentioned this, even as you enter, as Dar es Salaam entered, you know, the more economically stringent period towards the end of the socialist era, there's this vibrant nightlife, despite the fact that it's expensive, you know, mm-hmm. it's not cheap. Yeah. And there's this, like you said, this, the, you know, the trappings of modernity and luxury and consumption that are, like, again, they're not necessarily just telling us something about different mores or different ways of aspirations and thinking, but they're physically and socially changing the way people live and the way people experience the city. There's this notion that you use that I would like you to talk a little bit about, because I found it very very interesting and very provoking, not provoking, but just very insightful. This notion that these texts, like you said, they're artifacts that are not only representing something, but they're actually affecting change. You know, they're affecting urbanism. This notion that a new kind of urbanism is being affected by these sort of cultural artifacts. Can you tell us a little bit how you came to that conclusion, in other words?
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, maybe the first time I kind of had an inkling of that was, you know, I was interviewing a musician and he told me about a song that he wrote, you know, that was, you know, it was a song that was in many ways kind of, you know, it was critical of women. I can't remember the exact lyrics, but it was some song that basically the premise of it was, you know, all these women are, you know, coming to the city and they're robbing us blind and they're, you know, they're the downfall of all the young men in the city or something like that. And he told me how, you know, the rest of that week, women in the neighborhood would come to his house and pelt his house with rocks, you know, so he'd hear the sound of the rocks on his kind of metal roof. And he never sang that song again because, you know, there was, you know, it wasn't just a song. It was like a kind of conversation with all the people in the neighborhood, you know, like there was a kind of sense that you were having a big kind of moral debate about, you know, the people in your community. So when he told me that story, I started to kind of ask other musicians about that. And sure enough, they would tell me about the different kinds of you know, stories and about urban life that they were trying to kind of participate in, to kind of, you know, bring their own perspective to the story, to kind of render a kind of, you know, outcome. You know, whether it's, you know, in some ways it kind of took a sort of, you know, like trying to kind of, you know, control people's behavior, or not control, but to kind of chastise people if behaved in a way that was, you know, antisocial, or, you know, sometimes that, you know, they would try to chastise women, for example, they saw as not behaving appropriately. You know, or they would, you know, there's one song by the singer Marijani Rajabu about Masudi, which is this kind of was someone who was known as a kind of urban gangster at that time, you know, and it was a song kind of just, you know, it was kind of making fun of him, but also kind of chastising him for some of his behavior. The idea being that, you know, if you could publicly shame this person, then he would, you know, kind of be integrated back into the community again and not, you know, engage in that kind of behavior. So there was that sense of kind of really kind of participating in urban life and kind of affecting social outcomes with the kinds of songs that people sang. And that is, by the way, part of a longer tradition of Swahili, you know, music and performance poetry, the idea that, you know, by performing in public, you know, you're kind of taking a stance on public issues and trying to kind of affect the social fabric, you know, of urban life. Now, it wasn't always this kind of, you know, sort of positive kind of, you know, community building kind of exercise. There also was the side of that involved, you know, really kind of publicly shaming people, you know, like, and as I mentioned, particularly women, you know, for their behavior. So there was a sense in which that could also have really negative outcomes for people. You know, there could be a kind of a bullying aspect of it as well. But it really gives you a sense that this city that in many ways is this kind of cosmopolitan hub, you know, they're importing, you know, all this kind of music and fashion from different parts of the world. There's also very much an intimacy to these communities too, as they're kind of, you know, creating these spaces of public performance and public critique, you know, in these dance hall spaces with the performance of music and songs.
Yeah. And trying to sort of move a little bit into the next chapter, but very much connected to what you're saying, the chapter about Pulp Fiction, I thought was just incredible. I mean, I can't only imagine coming across with these texts and reading them. The notion of the briefcase publishers, again, you know, one can only imagine, given the scarcity of paper, the scarcity of all these things, having an entire industry thriving just by publishing this history, the stories. But these stories also that, like you said, are meant to sort of change, establish new ideas about values and society. And I particularly found it very interesting, this whole notion or this whole engagement what it means to be independent and how to defend independence and in this sort of like post-colonial setting and the relationship that that has to socialism or no socialism and the city, et cetera, like the entanglement of all those set of values and the way in which these values get sort of reframed by the authors of this pulp fiction. Can you tell us a little bit about this one, this chapter?
Mm-hmm. Sure. I'm so glad you liked that chapter. I had so much fun with these materials. I think in all, I found around 200 of these novellas, and you know, they were just found kind of at these used bookstores, and you know, kind of in the basement of the National Library, and just kind of all over the place. You know, they weren't all, you know, kind of centralized in one location, but they just felt like such treasures to find. And you know, I wasn't always sure how to read them at first because they're fiction. You know, they were made in Dar es Salaam in the 70s by migrants. You know, but how do you read fiction as an historical source? You know, this. So it was really a lot of fun to kind of figure out, you know, what I could learn from these. And one of the things, you know, so these, you know, basically the briefcase publishers, and that was kind of a sort of derogatory term, you know, used to describe them, that they themselves had embraced. But, you know, by kind of literary elites, you know, they weren't publishing with the kind of formal publishing houses of, you know, the you know, Tanzania Publishing House or the university presses. And these were kind of self-published underground, you know, texts that they made. And so if you look at them, many of them, you know, have tons of typos, they'll be missing pages, you know, they're just kind of self-made by these young men in the city without the kind of, you know, professional imprimatur of kind of a, you know, a kind of more institutionalized press. But so these, you know, and as you point out, this industry really flourished at the time when Dar es Salaam was in the most dire of economic straits. You know, these are times when, you know, when you interview people, they talk about not being able to find rice and sugar and tea. You know, these are the times of real scarcity when the economy was really collapsing. But these are the years when you have the most of these books published. You know, they're just available everywhere. So it's kind of an interesting contradiction how you can have such cultural bounty in a time of such economic scarcity. And so so these novellas are published, almost all of them are published by young men. And that's something that I talk about a bit, why that is. But they're published by young men, and these men are all, you know, they've been educated in the kind of socialist system. Most of them come from rural areas and are migrants in the city. They have education, they have literacy. And this is a generation that has been raised on the promises of African socialism and of prosperity and of having a kind of, you know, respectable middle-class living, but have largely been disappointed by those promises because they moved to the city at a time when, you know, it's an economic collapse. They're not able to kind of realize their aspirations to get married, to have a household, to find salaried employment. So in many ways, these novellas are the novellas of young men who are very frustrated with their position in life. They still kind of, you know, believe in the project of African socialism. They still hold out, you know, a kind of real kind of loyalty to the project of decolonization. But they're trying to rethink what that means in light of their own kind of circumstances. And they do that through these really kind of just really lively and like kind of, you know, these kind of pulp fiction novellas that draw on all these different genres. They draw on kind of crime thriller books. They draw on, you know, James Bond movies. They draw on kung fu films. You know, Bruce Lee kind of makes an appearance in some of them. They draw on spaghetti westerns. And they use these different genres to kind of try to humanize and narrate the kind of, you know, the predicament of young urban men in the city trying to make a living, trying to kind of find new modes of respectability in adulthood. Knowing that they can no longer kind of rely on the modes of adulthood and you know, security that their parents could in the rural areas, but yet the promises of African socialism also aren't really viable to them anymore. So how do they kind of make a new kind of urban masculinity, you know, in the context of a city that's, you know, in such dire straits, you know? And so they kind of craft these new kinds of modes of masculinity and urban belonging, you know, in the form of these pulp fiction novels.
Yeah, no, it was, and like I said, I think one of the interesting bits is, like you said, there's always this very interesting, it's not even that they're criticizing socialism openly, but they're like recreating it and trying to find a space for themselves or find a place of writing themselves in that story without necessarily rejecting the project. Which I think is just a fascinating sort of like enterprise. So then you close your last chapter talks about an urban lexicon, and so you focus on two terms, you know, the ujama and bongo, and you rightly say, you know, these are two sort of like the beginning at kind of like the beginning and the end, precisely for that reason. You know, we start with this notion of you know, socialism sort of represented in the term ujama, and then we end up with a completely, not a completely, but a different interpretation of that self-reliance that was sort of at the core of the socialist project. Tell us about this chapter and what is the transition from this one term to the next?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So, you know, in Tanzania today, you have this kind of this concept of bongo. So, you know, one of the most kind of popular genres of music is bongo flava, which is a kind of hip hop genre. And bongo literally means brains in Swahili. And so this becomes a real kind of like, you know, urban ethos in Tanzania, you know, in the 80s. You know, Dar es Salaam is often colloquially called bongo land. You know, somebody who's using their brain, who kind of has street savvy or a kind of urban, you know, kind of street smarts, you know, is known as someone who has bongo brains. So I was kind of interested in that, you know, like the kind of rise of that kind of term at the end of socialism. And so I was kind of looking into the different kinds of, you know, popular literature in Dar es Salaam, trying to kind of track it. And so I see it kind of becoming a term that people use like in the last years of socialism, you know, in the early 1980s. And one of the things I kind of am interested to look at is how bongo starts out as this kind of subversive kind of rallying call for urban youth, you know, who are, you know, kind of struggling in a society that's not really doing much to support them, you know, like with the kind of restrictions on, you know, black market trade, you know, young men are being arrested, for example, for selling loose cigarettes, you know, like people are, you know, young women are being arrested for wearing mini skirts. You know, there's this idea that like the state is really kind of attacking them rather than the real culprits, which are, you know, those who are, you know, who are becoming wealthy, you know, off of the citizens, you know, like corrupt politicians and other kinds of, you know, businessmen. There's this kind of sense of outrage that young people are being blamed for the ills of society. And so the idea about bongo is kind of trying to sort of, you know, valorize those kinds of, you know, youth qualities of urban life, of being street smart, of being able to, you know, mobilize your knowledge about the city to engage in black market trade, you know, to find secondhand clothes so you can look really sharp when you go out at night, to find access to things that, you know, you can only find if you know the networks of the city and have a kind of, you know, connection to it. So it starts out having this kind of real sort of subversive, you know, kind of connotation, you know, kind of against the sort of repressions of that time period, both economically and politically. But then one of the things I think that happens is, you know, with the kind of opening of the economy in 1985, the end of African socialism, you know, the second president of Tanzania, you know, he Ali Hassan Mwinyi has this nickname, which is, you know, Mzee Ruksa, which is, you know, kind of means permissive, Mr. Permissiveness, you know, in that, you know, he opened up the economy to all this kind of, you know, you know, to the outside world, basically. And you have, you know, this influx of imported goods, you know, that were restricted during the socialist period. You know, but you also have, you know, like with the expansion of these kinds of opportunities, you also have really massively rising levels of inequality. And, you know, and so, you know, for many people, life doesn't get better, it gets worse with that time, with that kind of shift. You know, people are, you know, poverty is still a major problem. And so bongo, you know, while in the earlier time had been this kind of subversive claim of street smart against a kind of society that discouraged that, now suddenly with this kind of neoliberal ethos of self-reliance, of, you know, being able to make one's way in the world, you know, through the open market, now bongo kind of becomes in many ways embraced by the state as a kind of entrepreneurial claim that everyone should be responsible for themselves. You know, you should no longer rely on the state. And so in many ways, the kind of critical edge that bongo had in earlier years as a kind of, you know, rallying call for urban youth, you know, now it becomes a kind of, you know, something that you're kind of forced upon you. You have to use your kind of street smarts to survive because no one is going to help you. There's no kind of expectation, you know, that society is obligated to you. So that's my kind of take on how that term really shifts in meaning, you know, from the early 80s and the last days of socialism to the kind of neoliberal era, you know, that comes on its heels.
Mm-hmm. By the end of the book, you finish with your conclusion with this, what I found lovely story of you exploring the basement of the National Library. And you use this term that you found, that exploration to be sort of like a map. And I was wondering whether, as I read that, I was wondering, a map in the sense of, it just gave you like a spatial sense of like the richness of this text, like this textual history, or a map in terms of like it allow you a sense of like orienting yourself into that, because in a way it is kind of I can just imagine like spatially thinking about like all of a sudden finding yourself in the midst of all this history that, like you said, had been at the archives, it had been sort of difficult to uncover or like penetrate. And this new experience, it was all there. It was a lot of it was there, but in a kind of chaos and like disjointedness. And I said, in a way, just seeing it in that way physically might have been both scary and reassuring. I was wondering, what was your experience of that moment?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so in many ways, I think that, you know, what I was trying to do with this book was a kind of literary history of Dar es Salaam. And there are so many other kinds of histories to write of Dar es Salaam. I mean, you know, not everybody was involved in that kind of print culture. So it is a very particular, you know, it's one version of that story. It's one particular kind of archive. The National Library, it's this big kind of, modernist building in downtown Dar es Salaam. And going into the basement is just, was such a, it was a really cool experience. And so many of the text, it's just stacked full of books and pamphlets. You know, a lot of them aren't really cataloged, and, a lot of them are just kind of covered in dust and, aren't really of much interest to many people who go in there these days. You know, a lot of people go in there to use the computers or to read the newspapers and stuff. And I just think it's like walking through the different kind of aisles of the library and seeing all these different kind of publications and translations, it just gives you a sense of the rich kinds of cultural worlds and imaginative work that people were doing in the 70s and 80s, the kinds of hopes that people had, the kinds of, creative visions they had for the society they lived in, that largely are lost. These are histories that, in many ways came to a close with the end of the socialist period, didn't really have much of a life after that. So there's something I think really just moving about seeing all the different kinds of imaginative worlds that people kind of, put together, using this kind of this using print culture, using literacy, using the written word.
I was wondering just to close, I had one last question. You do this really, really good job at contrasting the experiences that these migrants were going through in Dar es Salaam with those of other cities in the Global South. And I was wondering if you could give us an impression or just a sense of how do you think, in other words, Dar es Salaam was experiencing things that were being experienced in other cities, but at the same time, there are a lot of things that are very unique to the process that Dar es Salaam went through. Why do you think of this textual history sort of has marked Dar es Salaam, that's made it is unique to the city or is particularly characteristic to the city?
One of the things that I think is unique about Dar es Salaam, and this is something that I think, when you interview people about that time period, this really comes across as well, is the kind of sense that, even in the light of, economic restrictions, even as, there wasn't enough petrol for the buses to be running, even as you have, electricity not running for half the day, you have just this incredible kind of cultural productivity during those years, and part of it, I think, has to do with the kind of protectionist policies, the flip side of this kind of, banning of imported you know, television and music and literature, is that, you know, there was this real kind of, you know, homegrown industries like in music and in literature, you know, and other things. And so there was this sense that you could be involved in this kind of cultural life in the city, that there were all these novellas being published in Swahili. They weren't competing with imports from Europe or from other countries. You know, there was this real sense of a kind of commitment to locally produced art. So I think that was one of the really unique things about, you know, living in the city at this time. You know, people who were really struggling, you know, other parts of their life could still go out to a dance hall and see music pretty regularly. So I think that kind of cultural bounty of the time, you know, people really speak about that with a lot of nostalgia as one of the really beautiful things about being in the city at that time period.
Yeah, no, it definitely, it's, one imagines it and it's, it sounds like something to miss.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Kalachi, I think I've taken plenty of time from you. Could you just tell us what are your current projects?
Sure. Well, I'm currently working on two projects. Both are a bit different than the one that my first book. The first is a kind of a history of reproductive politics in post-colonial Africa in the 60s and 70s, starting from my work in Tanzania, but also, you know, working with archives in Kenya and Nigeria. But basically, it's kind of looking at the spread of you know, the family planning movement across Africa in the 60s and 70s, and focusing really on the role of African health workers as kind of public intellectuals. You know, as I kind of see it now, and I'm early in the state in the process, but is, you know, these health workers kind of had this kind of conundrum they were facing. You know, on the one hand, you know, access to contraception and family planning was a really kind of dire need. People really wanted this. And, you know, in the wake of colonial rule, health infrastructures were really underdeveloped and really were in need of resources. And yet, you know, at the same time, you know, in the kind of international community, there was this ethos of demographic control and population control that really kind of smacked of colonial eugenics, you know, and had kind of traces of racism in it. So I think there was a real kind of sense as African health workers, how do you deliver health to your community in a world where your access to those resources has this kind of legacy of racism and eugenics? How do you kind of work through that predicament and build a public health system? So that's the kind of one of the projects that I'm working on. The second one is kind of a different, kind of a U-turn for me. It's a kind of global history of this movement in the 70s called the Wages for Housework movement, which is a global feminist movement. Basically, you know, the central kind of argument of this movement was that, you know, we need to recognize and pay for the unpaid work that women do in the economy. That you know, basically the wages for housework was the idea that women's unpaid work is really what makes the world go round and should be the center of politics. sorry, I'm running out of my voice. It's kind of failing on me, but those are the two projects I'm doing now.
Well, they both sound wonderful, and we look forward to hopefully discussing them with you at some point in the future. So thank you very much for talking to us. I enjoyed it, and I'm sure our listeners will enjoy it too. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.